This is Melissa, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And this is Arizona History. Today's reading is from the Territorial News newspaper, dated December 11, 2024. The Minnesota Uprising. Sioux Revolt results in mass execution. In 1862, a group of Sioux Indians, fed up with U.S. government policies and starvation brought about by unscrupulous traders and Indian agents, rose up to expel white settlers from their native lands in what is now the state of Minnesota. Before the army could quell the rampage, known as the Dakota War of 1862, or the Minnesota Uprising, more than 500 settlers and hundreds of Indians and soldiers lay dead. The events culminated in the largest mass execution in the history of the United States. Up until the mid-19th century, the easternmost group of the Sioux peoples, known as the Dakota, controlled the northern Mississippi River Valley. As part of the United States government's campaign against Western Indian tribes, Dakota leaders were forced to sign the Treaty of Traverse des Sioux on July 23, 1851, and Treaty of Mendota on August 5, 1851. These treaties ceded large tracts of land in Minnesota Territory to the United States. In exchange for money and goods, the Dakota agreed to live on a 20-mile-wide Indian reservation centered on a 150-mile stretch of the upper Minnesota River. During the late 1850s, treaty violations by the United States and late or unfair annuity payments by Indian agents caused increasing hunger and hardship among the Dakota. On August 4, 1862, representatives of the Northern Sisseton and Wahpeton Dakota bands met at the Upper Sioux Agency in the northwestern part of the reservation and successfully negotiated to obtain food. However, when two other bands of the Dakota, the Southern Mattawacton and the Wapati, turned to the Lower Sioux Agency for supplies on August 15, 1862, they were rejected. Indian agent and Minnesota State Senator Thomas Galbraith managed the area and would not distribute food to these bands without payment. At a meeting of the Dakota, the United States government, and local traders, the Dakota representative asked the representative for the traders, Andrew Myrick, to support their cause. His response was a blunt, "So far as I'm concerned, if they are hungry, let them eat grass or their own dung." The meeting quickly deteriorated into shouting, and negotiations failed. On August 17, 1862, five American settlers were killed by four Dakota on a hunting expedition. That night, a council of Dakota decided to attack settlements throughout the Minnesota River Valley in an effort to drive whites out of the area. On August 18, 1862, Dakota Chief Little Crow led a group that attacked numerous white settlers in the first major engagement of the war, the Battle of Lower Sioux Agency. Andrew Myrick was among the first to be killed when he was discovered trying to escape through a second-floor window of a building at the agency. Myrick's body later was found with grass stuffed into his mouth. Minnesota Militia Forces and B Company of the 5th Minnesota Voluntary Infantry Regiment were sent to quell the uprising, but were defeated at the Battle of Redwood Ferry. At least 44 civilian and military deaths were reported during the two battles. Confident with their initial success, the Dakota continued their offensive and attacked the settlement of New Ulm, Minnesota, on August 19, 1862. Dakota warriors decided not to attack the heavily defended Fort Wrigley along the river and instead turned toward the town, killing settlers along the way. By the time New Ulm itself was attacked, residents had organized defenses in the town center and were able to keep the Dakota at bay during the brief siege. However, Dakota warriors were able to penetrate parts of the defenses, and portions of the town were burned. By that evening, a thunderstorm prevented further Dakota attacks, and New Ulm was reinforced by regular soldiers and militia from nearby towns, including two companies of the 5th Minnesota Voluntary Infantry, then stationed at Fort Wrigley, while the population continued to build barricades around the town. Fort Wrigley was attacked by the Dakota on August 21, 1862. Although the Dakota were not able to take the fort, their ambush of a relief party from the fort to New Ulm on August 21st and the main power expended in defense at the Battle of Fort Wrigley greatly reduced the strength of the American forces. The Dakota also undertook raids on farms and small settlements throughout south-central Minnesota and what was then eastern Dakota Territory. Counterattacks by Minnesota militia against these raiding parties again resulted in a major defeat of American forces at the Battle of Birch Coulee on September 2, 1862. A three-hour firefight began an early morning assault. 13 soldiers were killed and 47 were wounded, while two Dakota were killed. A column of 240 soldiers from Fort Wrigley relieved the detachment at Birch Coulee the same afternoon. Further north, the Dakota attacked several unfortified stage stops and river crossing along the Red River Trails, a settled trade route between Fort Garry, now Winnipeg, Manitoba, and St. Paul, Minnesota, in the Red River Valley in northwestern Minnesota and eastern Dakota Territory. In the meantime, steamboat and flatboat trade on the Red River came to a halt, and mail carriers, stage drivers, and military couriers were killed while attempting to reach settlements such as Pemba, North Dakota, Fort Garry, St. Cloud, Minnesota, and Fort Snelling. Due to the demands of the Civil War, repeated appeals for assistance were necessary before President Abraham appointed General John Pope to lead troops from the 3rd Minnesota Volunteer Infantry Regiment and 4th Minnesota Voluntary Infantry Regiment to quell the violence. Minnesota Governor Alexander Ramsey also enlisted the help of Colonel Harry Hastings Sibling, the previous governor, to aid in the effort. After the arrival of a larger army force, the final large-scale fighting took place at the Battle of Wood Lake on September 23, 1862. According to the official report of Lieutenant Colonel William R. Marshall of the 7th Minnesota Volunteer Infantry Regiment, elements of the 7th Minnesota and the 6th Minnesota Volunteer Infantry Regiment and a 6-pounder cannon were deployed equally in dugouts and in a skirmish line. After brief fighting, the forces in the skirmish line charged against the Dakota and defeated them overwhelmingly. Hundreds of Dakota families surrendered, and their warriors were imprisoned. With as many as 800 settlers dead, white leaders called for revenge, and 303 Dakota warriors were sentenced to death at Mankota. Heeding Indian policy reformers and advocates, President Abraham Lincoln commuted the sentence of all but 39 of the Dakota. One of the Indians was granted a last-minute reprieve, but the other 38 were hanged simultaneously on December 26, 1862, at Mankota, in the largest mass execution in U.S. history. The remaining convicted Indians stayed in prison that winter. The following spring, they were transferred to Rock Island, Illinois, where they were held in prison for almost 4 years. By the time of their release, one-third of the prisoners had died of disease. In April 1863, the United States Congress abolished the reservation, declared all previous treaties with the Dakota null and void, and undertook proceedings to expel the Dakota people entirely from Minnesota. To this end, a bounty of $25 per scalp was placed on any Dakota found free within the boundaries of the state. Between 1,300 and 1,700 Dakota were arrested and held during the winter of 1862 through 1863 in a compound on Pike Island near Fort Snelling, Minnesota. In early 1863, the camp was moved southwest near the present-day site of the Mall of America. But on May 4, 1863, the Dakota were removed to Nebraska and South Dakota. More than 130 Dakota died in the camp and subsequent removal. Little Crow was killed on July 3, 1863, by a settler who wished to collect the $25 bounty. Little Crow's scalp was exhibited in the Minnesota State Historical Society until 1915. In 1971, Little Crow's remains were returned to his family. He is buried in Flandreau, South Dakota. Mark Twain, Roughing It. In 1861, Mark Twain's brother, Orion, was named Secretary of Nevada Territory. Twain joined his brother for the trip west. 11 years later, Twain described his journey in the book Roughing It. Although its approach is humorous, the book's descriptions are accurate. As Twain notes in his preface, there is information in the volume, information concerning an interesting episode in the history of the Far West, about which no books have been written by persons who were on the ground in person and saw the happenings of the time with their own eyes. The movies create an idyllic impression of riding the overland stage, smooth travel in roomy comfort. Twain paints a much different picture. Passengers crammed together with mailbags, jostled by every bump, breathing dust, and at the mercy of Mother Nature. However, for its time, the stagecoach offered the latest technology in traveling, carrying its careening passengers across the western plains at speeds greater than any other transport available. Starting out, Twain begins his journey in St. Joseph, Missouri, the starting point for the overland route to Sacramento, California. Twain and his brother Orion discover that passengers are limited to only 25 pounds of baggage. After shedding much of their luggage, the intrepid travelers are on their way across the plains of Kansas. Our coach was a swingin' and swayin' cage of the most sumptuous description, an imposing cradle on wheels. It was drawn by 6 handsome horses, and by the side of the driver sat the conductor, the legitimate captain of the craft. For it was his business to take charge and care of the mails, baggage, express matter, and passengers. We 3 were the only passengers this trip. We sat on the back seat inside. About all the rest of the coach was full of mail bags, for we had 3 days delayed mail with us. Almost touching our knees, a perpendicular wall of mail matter rose up to the roof. There was a great pile of it strapped on top of the stage, and both the fore and hind boots were full. We had 2,700 pounds of it aboard. The driver said, "A little for Brigham and Carson and Frisco, but the heft of it for the engines, which is powerful troublesome. Thought they'd get plenty truck to read." But as he just then got up fearful convulsion of his countenance, which was suggestive of a wink being swallowed by an earthquake, we guessed that his remark was intended to be factious, and to mean that we would unload the most of our mail matter somewhere on the plains and leave it to the Indians, or whosoever wanted it. We changed horses every 10 miles, all day long, and fairly flew over the hard, level road. We jumped out and stretched our legs every time the coach stopped, and so the night found us still vivacious and unfatigued. Traveling. The next day, the stage suffers a breakdown, forcing its passengers to evacuate while repairs are being made. The conductor lays the blame for the mishap on the extra weight of too many mail bags. After throwing half the mail onto the prairie, the stage resumes its journey. Oren's large unabridged dictionary causes trouble along the way. Whenever the stage stopped to change horses, we would wake up and try to recollect where we were and succeed, and in a minute or two the stage would be off again, and we likewise. We began to get into country now, threaded here and there with little streams. These had high, steep banks on each side, and every time we flew down one bank and scrambled up the other, our party inside got mixed somewhat. First, we would all lie down in a pile at the forward end of the stage, nearly in a sitting posture, and in a second we would shoot to the other end and stand on our heads. And we would sprawl and kick to and ward off ends and corners of mailbags that came lumbering over us and about us. And as the dust rose from the tumult, we would all sneeze in chorus. The majority of us would grumble and probably say something hasty thing like, "Take your elbow out of my ribs. Can't you quit crowding?" Every time we avalanched from one end of the stage to the other, the unabridged dictionary would come too. And every time it came, it damaged somebody. One trip, it barked the secretary's elbow. The next trip, it hurt me in the stomach. And the third, it tilted Bemma's nose up till he could look down his nostrils, he said. The pistols and coins soon settled to the bottom, but the pipes, pipe stems, tobacco, and canteens clattered and floundered after the dictionary every time it made an assault on us, and aided and abetted the book by spilling tobacco in our eyes and water down our backs. The way station. Each evening, the stage announces its approach to a way station by the driver blowing a bugle. The way station offers sparse comfort. The station buildings were long, low huts made of sun-dried, mud-colored bricks, laid up without mortar. Adobes, the Spaniards call these bricks, and Americans shorten it to dobies. The roofs, which had no slant to them worth speaking of, were thatched and then sodded or covered with a thick layer of earth, and from this sprang a pretty rank growth of weeds and grass. It was the first time we had ever seen a man's front yard on top of his house. The buildings consisted of barns, stable room for 12 or 15 horses, and a hut, eating room for passengers. This latter had bunks in it for the station keeper and a hostler or two. You could rest your elbow on its eaves, and you had to bend over in order to get in at the door. In place of a window, there was a square hole about large enough for a man to crawl through, but this had no glass in it. There was no flooring, but the ground was packed hard. There was no stove, but fireplace served all needful purposes. There were no shelves, no cupboards, no closets. In a corner stood an open sack of flour, and nestling against its base were a couple of black and vulnerable tin coffee pots, a tin teapot, a little bag of salt, and a side of bacon. By the door of the station keeper's den outside was a tin wash basin on the ground. Near it was a pail of water and a piece of yellow soap, and from the eaves hung a hoary blue woolen shirt, significantly, but this latter was the station keeper's private towel, and only two persons in all the party might venture to use it, the stage driver and the conductor. Near Salt Lake City, the stage passes a wagon train filled with Mormons making the trek westward. Just beyond the breakfast station, we overtook a Mormon immigrant train of 33 wagons, and tramping wearily along and driving their herd of loose cows were dozens of coarse-clad and sad-looking men, women, and children who had walked as they were walking now, day after day, for 8 lingering weeks. And in that time had compassed the distance our stage had come in 8 days and 3 hours, 798 miles. They were dusty, uncombed, hatless, bonnetless, and ragged, and they did look so tired. Love and horses. No creature on earth is more noble, more patient, more obedient, and more plain old helpful than a good horse, well broke by a man who loves her dear. On a hot day in the middle of no place, she's also the best-looking gal anywhere. If they made bride's gowns to fit a paint horse, I'd soon marry the horse as a woman, but I don't know a horse who would have me. Oliver Curtis, El Paso, Texas, 1912. A jealous woman. Jealousy's a funny thing with women. A man gets jealous. He gets right to the bottom of it. He screams, yells, shoots, whatever it takes to clear the air. But a woman, she just stews and plots and waits. It's almost enough to scare a man onto the straight and narrow. Jack Mahone, Casper, Wyoming, 1946. The following readings are from the Territorial News, December 25th, 2024. Indian agents. The only important civilian official most Native Americans in the West ever saw was the Indian agent, whose post was created in President Washington's day. 12 agencies were set up in 1834 and put under the Department of the Interior in 1849. The agent provided the federal government with what little it asked to know about Indians and represented the great white father out in the wilds. Often with only his wife, a sub-agent, and interpreter to help him, a representative had to handle Indian relations over hundreds of square miles and also aid any whites passing through. A good agent would recruit a farmer and teacher, and his outpost would become a dot of civilization in the wilderness. Log homes and an office, warehouses, a smithy and farm buildings, a school and council houses, corn and potato fields, orchards and farm animals. He had to journey far among the tribes for powwows and entertain any Indians who came to the agency for talks. He won tribal friendships by giving the chiefs medals, flags, and supplies, feeding their people in times of need, and sending presents to their families when they died. He tried, usually in vain, to keep white poachers from encroaching on Indian lands and white traders from selling liquor to Indians. Equally unsuccessful was his attempt to vaccinate Indians and teach them farming. They resisted both. He fined any foreigner found trading furs without a permit and tried to punish Indians who harmed whites. He also took a census, enforced the stipulations of U.S. Indian treaties, and distributed annuities to the tribes. Unfortunately, most agents were dishonest, arranging for kickbacks from traders and pocketing annuity money. But a few were incorruptible. Lawrence Taliaferro, the agent at Fort Snelling, Minnesota, spent more than $1,000 of his own money to buy supplies for the tribes. After he retired, Sioux chiefs visited him, and Little Crow said, "My old father, we love you. We respect you. Since you left us, a dark cloud has hung over our nation. We know your heart." With a largely indifferent government thousands of miles away in Washington, D.C., the qualified and dedicated agents could really achieve little with the resources given them. Reservation lands were typically poor, and supplies and equipment were often inappropriate, outdated, or in disrepair. Arizona Web of Time by Jim Harvey. Wild plants provided food for Arizona's American Indians, even when they were growing corn. They also provided medicine for a variety of ailments. Wild acorns were ground into meal and cooked. Pinyon nuts and sunflower seeds were parched or roasted. Beeweed was boiled with wild onions and celery. Other wild foods included mint, parsley, spinach, and strawberries. Bottle brush juice was swallowed to ease headache and fever. Cactus, with the stickers removed, was used as a compress to ease the pain of rheumatism. At Tucson, a man named Mansfield opened Arizona Territory's first public library in 1871. He also sold California newspapers delivered by buckboard. In southeast Arizona's Graham County in 1889, bandits held up a U.S. Army paymaster and stole $28,345 in gold and silver coins. The bandits got away, and the coins were never recovered. 1896 was the year cases of smallpox were reported at Flagstaff, Prescott, Williams, and Ash Fork. There also were outbreaks of measles among Flagstaff children and adults. A fire destroyed nearly all of the 1900 business district at Prescott. The fire was started by an overturned kerosene lamp. The rebuilt business district has survived to this day. There were community dances Saturday evenings during 1904 at a Flagstaff schoolhouse. Waltzes, the two-step, and the polka were popular. This is Melissa, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org, all lowercase. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then, under Programming Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. You can hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.